Okay, we're on page 382, Perek Tezvov, Pasuk Chav Zayin, right after Chamishi. Or at Chamishi. No, Vayavo'u Elima. Not Vayavo'i, whatever.
That doesn't make you right.
Right. The last thing we learned, okay, after the Hashem split the sea, the Jews went through, the Egyptians were drowned. They came to a city called Mara. The water was bitter. They couldn't drink it. They complained. Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu to take a tree, throw it into the water. The water became sweet. The Jews drank. And Hashem said that if you listen to the mitzvahs, all the illnesses that I gave unto Egypt, I won't give upon you, because I am Hashem, your doctor, and we learned that's the whole concept of preventive medicine. 382. Okay, so now the Jews traveled again, and it says, Vayavayu Elima, they came to the city of Elima, of Elim, Risham, and they found there, Shtei Masrei Enes Mayim, 12 wells, Vishivin Tamarim, and 70 day trees, Vayachnu Shom Alamayim, and they camped next to the water. Now, Rashi says, what were the 12 wells and the 70 palm trees? The 12 wells corresponds with the 12 tribes. The 70 palm trees, like it says in the Pasuk, Tzadik Katam Yifrach, a tzadik will blossom like the palm trees, refers to the 70 elders. You know, there are 70 elders of the Jewish people, the Sanhedrin, the big rabbinic court. So therefore, they had the 12 wells and the 70 palm trees. The Medrash said, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar brings on the Medrash that says that these were designated from the beginning of creation. From the beginning of time, God ordered that when the Jews will come to this particular place, there should be the 12 wells and the 70 palm trees. In fact, other people say that right before the Jews got there, it wasn't even there. In other words, God did a miracle that it got there when the Jews did. And it was from the 6 days of creation. Okay? And that's where they camped, and it was very good for them because they had their needs. They had what to eat and they had what to drink. Vayisum Elim, Pasuk continues, chapter 16, Perek Tazayin. Vayisum Elim, the Jews traveled from Elim. Vayaveo kol adas b'nei Yisrael and midbar Sin. The entire Jewish nation came to the desert of Sin, which is between Elim, which was the first city they were at, and Beit Sinai. B'chamisha asi yom l'chedesh hasheni, on the 15th day of the second month, meaning the month of Iyar, l'tzei Samaritan Mitzrayim, from the time the Jewish people left Egypt. Now, in other words, this is traveling towards Har Sinai. So they were in Mara. From Mara they went to Elim, where they had the wells and the 70 palm trees. Then they went to this new place, El Midbar Sin. This was between Elim and Sinai. Between Midbar Sinai and Har Sinai. So the Jews are getting closer to being able to receive the Torah. Rashi says, why is the Pasuk telling us when they camped? All the other campings in the 40 years of the desert, the Torah doesn't tell us when they camped. Just like in the previous Pesukim, they came to Elim. It doesn't say when it was. They came to Mara. The Torah doesn't say when it was. Why is the Torah explaining over here when it was? So Rashi explains, and the commentators elaborate on this a lot. When the Jews left Egypt, it was on the 15th day of Nisan. The food they took out with them from Egypt lasted them for 30 days, which in itself was a miracle. Because remember, we learned they were rushed out of Egypt and they baked the mats on the backs. And they're in such a big rush to get out, the dough didn't even have a chance to rise. This dough, this food, lasted for 30 days. When it came the 15th day of Iyar, which is a month exactly after Pesach, they ran out of food. Now they started complaining, we have nothing to eat, as we'll see in the next passage. Why didn't they complain until now? So obviously because they still had food from the time they left Egypt. And therefore, it wasn't a problem.
But you said they did complain.
They complained about nothing to drink. They complained about...
Close the door, honey.
What?
You said they didn't have food. They had food, but then you said...
They complained before that the water was bitter. They didn't complain for food because they had what to eat. Let's put it this way. Jews always complained. Okay. Even when they have, they complained. We know that. But when they had food, they didn't complain they didn't have food. When they didn't have what to drink or the water was bitter, that's when they complained there was nothing to drink. So before, when they complained, Hashem gave them sweet, the water became sweet. Now we're going to learn the real complaint of the Jewish people, that they had nothing to eat. What?
They didn't have their steak.
Correct. Well, they didn't have steak and then... Okay. So the Pasuk says, it was at that day that the food finished and they had nothing left to eat. Okay. And this itself, by the way, the commentators explain, this itself was a miracle that they had food for 30 days, what they took out. All the Jews complained against Moshe and Aaron in the desert. Why is the Pasuk saying that they're complaining in the desert? Because the Pasuk wants to teach us, again, they're blaming Moshe Rabbeinu for taking the Jews out into a desert. He said, you have no better place, you have no other way to take us that we can go in a way where there's food to buy and food to get. So that's why the emphasis is again by Midbar. They complained that they in the that the fact he took them out in the desert. And as the Pasuk says again, Vayomer Aleihem Bnei Yisrael, the Jewish people said to Moshe and Aaron, Miyitim Musayna Biyad Hashem, would have been only the God given that we should die in Egypt. B'shifteinu Al Sir HaBasar, when we ate, when we sat really on the pot of meat. When we ate plenty of bread, that you took us out into this wilderness, that we should all die in hunger. And as the commentators explain, hunger is a very severe type of a death. It's a very torturous death. So he's saying, you could have kept us in Egypt, we would have not... been suffering from hunger, we would have been able to have plenty of food like we had in Egypt. We had meat and we had bread and we had all the luxuries of life, so to speak, and you took us out into the desert. Okay, now they write like this. If they would have died in Egypt, they said it wouldn't have been so bad. What did the Jews say? If we only died in Egypt instead of dying here in hunger. So our Rechaim HaKadosh explains, that's because if they're dying already, they said it would have been better to die in Egypt during the 3 days of darkness when all the Jews that didn't want to go out died. At least we would have been buried. We wouldn't have to go through the hunger pains of dying in that way. Now, the Ramban explains, why is the Torah explaining over here that they were in the desert? I mean, the Torah says it, the Torah says they came to Midbar Sin. Why does it again say Bamidbar in the desert and all those things? One of the reasons the Jews complained, because they were in a desert. What does it mean? When you look at the vastness of the desert, and you see there's no food around for an extended period of time, at least in your mind, so automatically you're going to be more hungry. There's the famous Gemara that we learned. The Gemara says, Mishi yeshli pas besale, whoever has bread in their basket is not hungry. If you have bread in your basket, the Gemara's expression is, you're never hungry. In modern day language, it works a very much simpler way. On a regular day, we've mentioned this many times, on a regular day, you don't eat breakfast, let's say, until 9 o'clock. And you're not hungry until 9 o'clock. On a fast day, 7 o'clock in the morning, you already have a headache, and you're hungry, and you're thirsty, and the question is, you don't eat breakfast anyway until 9. Why are you hungry 7 o'clock in the morning? The answer is because on a regular day, you know, whenever you want food, you can go take food. On a fast day, you know you don't have food. The same thing over here, the Jews were in the Midbar. So the Pasuk is emphasizing, why did they complain? Because they were in the desert, and they saw no food around. So that's why when they ran out of food, they got scared. They panicked. And they started screaming, Tashem, hey, we're hungry. The same thing, by the way, another mashu that we gave many times, which every parent, or a person who was a parent, would know, that whenever you take your kids into the car on a trip, 10 minutes into the trip, they need the bathroom, and they're hungry and thirsty, and they're going crazy. If they'd be in the house, they wouldn't need the bathroom, and they wouldn't need a drink. Why is it? No, there's a reason for it. Why is it that all of a sudden they go into the car for 10 minutes, they need the bathroom? Because psychologically, at home, they know whenever we need the bathroom, so then we have it. So I don't need it. Because whenever we have it, we need it, we have it. But when you go in a car where there is no bathroom, so that's when the kids start needing the bathroom. No, they're psychologically like this. And this is really what the Gemara says. Mishi yeshli pas besalei, a person has bread in his basket, is not hungry. So the Ramban explains the fact that the Jews were in the Midbar, that itself made them hungry. That itself made them complain that they don't have food. So what do they say? So they complained to Hashem, or to Moshe Rabbeinu basically. The Or HaChaim just adds one point over here. The Jews seem to say that in Egypt it was much better. They had meat and they had bread and they had everything. But they were slaves. What do you think they had already? So the Mefarshim learn who's complaining over here. The Or HaChaim explains these are the officers, the ones that weren't actually enslaved. The Jewish officers that were in charge of the slaves, they were the ones that were complaining because they weren't slaves. So they had meat and they had bread and they had all the things. So now they're complaining that in Egypt we had it and here we don't have it. So Hashem said to Moshe, Hinini mamte lochem, and this is a very interesting point, and this is the concept of the man. Everybody knows the man, or the manna as it's called in English, fell for 40 years in the desert. Here is the origin of the man. This is the time when the man started falling. Because we said for the first month leaving Egypt they didn't need it, and then the second month started, they had no food, so they complained to Hashem. So Hashem said like this, Hashem said to Moshe, Hinini mamte lochem lechem min hashamayim, I'm going to rain bread coming down from the heaven. And the nation should go out and gather it every day. Meaning, they should only collect for what they need that day. I'm going to explain this whole thing in a second. The man on the sandal that I, because I'm testing them, hayelech b'teirasi imloi, if they're going to be going in the ways of my Torah or not. Okay, so basically the pasuk says, okay, God says, I'm accepting your requests. I'm going to rain bread from the heaven. Now, there's a number of things over here. First of all, what does it mean he's going to rain bread? What's this expression of raining the bread? The man actually fell down like rain from heaven. It actually fell down. And in fact, according in halacha, what bracha did they make on the man? It says, Amotzi lechem min hashamayim. They couldn't make a bracha, Amotzi lechem min ha'aretz, because it didn't come from the ground. It came lechem min hashamayim. So the poskim, the mefarshim write that on the man they made the bracha meitzi lechem min hashemayim.
Did they make
brachas? Yeah. Why not? First of all, what did they after Matan Torah?
Oh, this is after?
No, but I'm saying it's still they had the man for 40 years. The truth is, the question is really a stronger question. Brachas are of rabbinic origin.
Oh, okay. After brachas.
Benching after eating, if you eat bread and you're full, so then the Torah says, V'chalta v'savata berachta. You'll eat, you'll be full, and then you'll bench or say grace. The fact that we make a bracha before eating is rabbinic, but the poskim seem to write that they did make brachas. There was no obligation to make brachas before, but they did make brachas, and the bracha on the man would be Amei Tzilach Min HaShemayim. It was heavenly bread. And in fact, the Medrash brings down that Rabbi Akiva says that this is the food that angels eat, not the Anaheim angels, the real angels.
I know who you are.
Okay, good. I just when the you know the angels ate. So the Medrash asked, but what do you mean that the angels don't have a body and they don't eat? And what it means is the man. In fact, in Chassidus and Kabbalah, there's a lot discussed about the man, about the lofty level, which attributes of godliness the man came from. Is an extremely lofty level. And that level of godliness in the spiritual realm was the food, you know, the spirituality for the angels. When that level of spirituality lowered itself lower, 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 until it came down into the physical world, it ended up to be man. But the man, as the commentators explain, the man was so pure and so refined, there was no waste in the man. In other words, nobody had to go to the bathroom, so to speak, after eating the man. There was no waste. Normally, when you eat food today, so, you know, the stomach separates the good and the bad, you know, the good food, good part of the food your body keeps, and the waste your body lets out. In the man, there was no waste.
I know some people that keep
most of the food they keep. There's a, in Chassidus it explains that in Kedusha, in holiness, there's sharing. There's unity. In evil, which is selfish, it's me, me, me. There's no sharing. In holiness, like you have all the attributes. In chesed, you have chesed of chesed, gvur of chesed. You know, there's all this unity of all the opposite spheres. In Kedusha, in evil, there is no. So the Gemara, it's really a Gemara. The Gemara says an expression, there's a bug that's called Yitush. Yitush is sometimes defined as a mosquito or a gnat, but it's a little bug. And the Gemara says about this Yitush, it's a very unique creature. It's the only creature that's machnis ve'ena maitzi. It takes in food, whatever it eats, and it doesn't give out any waste. So in the Gemara, it classifies it as a very low-level bug. In Chassidus, it explains that that level of Yitush, what the Gemara is referring to, is such a level of evil that it's only me, me, me. It doesn't even share waste. It doesn't share anything. It keeps everything completely for itself. That is the level of Yitush that the Gemara says that if a human will be haughty, God will say, what are you so great about? Even the bugs, the Yitush was before you. Because mankind was created the last in creation. So, it says the man was so spiritual and so great that it actually is the food of the angels. In the spiritual man. Coming down physically, it actually becomes a form of physical food. But that's how great it was. Okay, so what does Hashem say? I'm going to make it rain, and the nation is going to go out and gather, dvayom b'yomei means the daily thing. They can only get for that day. In fact, later it says, one of the mitzvahs connecting to the man, and that's why Hashem says in this pasuk, l'mana nesen, I'm doing it, I should test them, if they'll go in my Torah or not. What was the test? If they'll listen to the mitzvahs connected to the man. What were the mitzvahs connected to the man? You can only gather for that day. You're not allowed to leave it over for the next day. Shabbat, Friday, it fell double, and you get double portion, all the various mitzvahs that are connected to the month. But the Gemara says, the Medrash says, there are so many miracles connected to the month. No matter how much you gathered, you always ended up with the same amount. In other words, whether you're gathering for an hour or for 5 minutes, the miracle was it always ended up the same exact amount. When you measured it, you didn't get more, you didn't get less. You got exactly a day's need. If you left it over, it became completely eaten by worms. There was nothing left. Then, the Medrash, based on various different psukim that we find in the Chumash, discussing the man, the Medrash says, there are three levels. If you are a tzaddik, the man fell right outside your door. If you were not such a great person, but not so bad, you have to walk a little bit out of your house to get the man. If you're a wicked person, you have to go outside the camp to get the man. Also, the Medrash says, for certain people, the man was edible as is. Other people had to just bake it. Other people had to grind it into food. Another uniqueness of the man, this miracle food, another miracle of the man was, it tasted whatever you wanted it to taste like. Except like watermelon, cucumbers, that the Gemara says was bad for pregnant women, so that's a few things that the man didn't taste like. If you wanted prime rib, the man tasted like prime rib. You wanted pizza, it tasted like pizza. Whatever you wanted it to taste, that's what the man tasted like. But it actually was, but Hashem says, the man and the son, I'm doing this to test you, to know if you're going to go in my ways or not. Now, sure. Where do I get it from?
Yeah, what you were saying. Where is it from?
The Medrash, there's certain sentences later on in Chumash, in Bahalaischa, when the Jews also complain about meat, that's when God sent them the quails, the slav. So over there, there's different psukim that discuss it, but the Medrash says, Rashi brings it down later on in Chumash also. The Medrash says, based because one pasuk said they had to go out to gather, they had to go out. Some places says you just open the doors. So there are various different sentences that seem to imply different things. So the Medrash said we referred to various different levels of people.
And I understand all that by one sentence written here about the month.
That's the way the oral Torah works. It was all given to Moshe at Har Sinai. And the explanation of it is elaborated on the Torah. So I'll give you an example. The Torah says by Shabbos, don't desecrate Shabbos. Don't do work on Shabbos. It's a one-liner. But you have tractates of Talmud and books of Code of Jewish Law discussing what does that pasuk mean. But it was all given to Moshe at Har Sinai in the oral tradition. It was transmitted orally until finally in the time of the Talmud they decided to write it down because people were forgetting it. But it was all taught to Moshe in the 40 days that he was on Har Sinai. In Mount Sinai.
40 days or 40 years? Actually?
40 days.
The whole thing? The whole Midrash for 40 days?
Well, the Medrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was... First, you have to understand, he had a great teacher, God. He was a great student, Moshe. He didn't have all the distractions of the internet, VCRs, nightclubs, sports,
women.
He was up there alone on the mountain.
Why not 40 years? Why did you say 40 days?
No, because when Moshe Rabbeinu was in Har Sinai for 40 days and 40 nights, that's when he got
all of
Torah in a general way. And then in the next 40 years, as God gave him more mitzvahs and more mitzvahs and more explanations came out, then even then, not the entire Torah was revealed. It was revealed as history goes on. But it was all given to Moshe. It was just transmitted orally in the various ways of defining and explaining the Torah that the Torah says you can explain it by.
It doesn't say in Perkei Avot Moshe received the Torah.
No.
He received as much as he could based on his human birth. Then he gave it all.
Yeah, so, what's the...
So in other words...
I'll tell you... Okay, I'm going to strengthen his question with the stranger Gemara. Well, not that direction question. Her question. It's really your question, but it was her question. Okay, what's the difference? There's a very strange Gemara that we learned. We learned this Gemara, we discussed this Gemara in the past. Moshe Rabbeinu once told God, I would like to see the Torah learning of the future generations. I want to see the Torah learning of future generations. So Hashem said, Moshe Rabbeinu, no problem. He he put him into Rabbi Akiva's class. And the Gemara says he wasn't sitting in the front row, he was sitting closer to the back. And Moshe Rabbeinu was listening to Rabbi Akiva teach. Rabbi Akiva teaching Torah.
Rabbi Akiva was before
Moshe? This is not a history class, lady. Moshe Rabbeinu, Rabbi Akiva. From Moshe Rabbeinu to Rabbi Akiva was probably 20 generations.
Maybe 2,000 years.
Rabbi Akiva lived in the time of the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. That means he had the 420 years of the second Beis Hamikdash, 70 years in between, 400 years and 10 years of the first Beis Hamikdash, plus all those years from Moshe Rabbeinu until Shlomo HaMelech. From Moshe Rabbeinu until Shlomo HaMelech was 7 generations. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was the 7th, David HaMelech was the 14th, Shlomo HaMelech was the 15th generation from Avraham Avinu. So you had 8 generations from David to, from Moshe Rabbeinu until David HaMelech. Then you had 410 years, plus 70, plus 420 years until Rabbi Akiva. So you're talking a long period of time. But Hashem took Moshe Rabbeinu into later years, into a time machine of the future. Now, so Moshe Rabbeinu is sitting to, listening to Rabbi Akiva teacher class.
Internet,
yeah. A space, what's it called? Star Trek? What's it called, this stuff? There's still some there. Okay, whatever.
Star Trek.
Star Trek. Oh, that's it. Star Trek. She's intelligent. She's educated.
I never watched it, but I know the name.
Okay.
She watches TV.
Okay. TV is Torah Vedas. Torah knowledge.
You hear that, Lolita?
Now.
Yeah, I do imagine.
So Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, Moshe Rabbeinu sitting in Rabbi Akiva's class. And Rabbi Akiva is teaching the class. And Rabbi Akiva says something Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know. He said a halacha Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know. So the Gemara says, Niskarkum upon of Shemesh. Moshe Rabbeinu like had a chill attack, you know. What's going on over here? This guy's teaching something I don't know. So a student all of a sudden asked Rabbi Akiva, says, Rabbi, where do you know this din from? Where do you know this law from? So he said, it was given to Moses at Sinai. It's halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. So Moshe Rabbeinu heard this. The Gemara says, and it's a Gemara Menachos. He felt better. What is it, kindergarten over here? Moshe Rabbeinu was upset. All of a sudden he heard his name mentioned. He felt good. You know, it made him Misha Berach. So his name felt, you know, so he was good. What's going on over here? And what does it mean that it was given to Moshe at Sinai? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know about it. How could that be? So how could it be given? The same thing the Rebbe explains, you have a famous Gemara, that the Gemara's wording contradicts itself. The Gemara says, Kol Masha Talmud Vosik Osid L'chadish. Anything that a competent Torah student will come up with new chidush, Kvar Nitna L'Moshe M'Sinai was already given to Moshe Har Sinai. It's a contradiction of terms. You're coming along saying, any new thing that a student comes up with was already given to Moshe at Sinai. So if it was already given, then it's not new. And if it's not new, how could you say it was already given? The statement contradicts itself. So what is the explanation? Which is, by the way, the answer to your question. The explanation is very simple. Moshe Rabbeinu and Har Sinai, like we learned many times in the past, got the generalizations of Torah. The general rules of Torah. Okay? The details which are derived from the generalizations. So as we say in Davening every day, Bishlesha Simides HaTorah Nidreshes and Rabbi Shmuel Aimer, that the Torah could be learned in 13 ways. So Moshe Rabbeinu got the general concepts of Torah, and in each generation, people revealed details, they revealed details from the generalizations. So, Moshe Rabbeinu basically was given those details, are all included, really, in the revelations that Moshe Rabbeinu got of the general rules of Torah. Nevertheless, they were revealed by the later generations. So from that respect of revelation, it's new. Because the new student revealed it. Moshe Rabbeinu, though, it was given to him already, because it's not a new world that never existed. It's a general, it's a detail of the general world that already pre-existed from the time of Sinai. To give you in modern day language, okay? You won't find in Torah, in other words, what do generations do as they, I don't want to say progress because we regress, as generations regress on and on, what they do is applying guidelines of Torah to the present day situation. To give you an example, you have medical issues today, like heart transplants. Give you an example, heart transplants, maybe one day brain transplants, or all these various different technological things, you know, whatever, huh? The scientific developments, whether medical or science, all those things. Now, does the Gemara talk about heart transplants? Of course not. There's no mention of heart transplants in the Gemara because there were no heart transplants in the time of the Gemara. Yet, from the Gemara, from the Talmud, you would be able to make a ruling if a heart transplant is permissible or not. And that's elaborate because it's much more complicated than what I'm saying now, but in a nutshell, the Gemara can define, I'll give you, where do you find in the Gemara the concept of heart transplants? I mean, there's no heart transplants talked about in the Gemara. But you have guidelines in the Gemara that will tell you if you're allowed to do it or not. For instance, the Gemara will discuss the definition of death. Okay? And again, I'm not going into halachic, so don't start asking me halachic, because it's very complicated. But you can have brain death, and you can have respiratory death. You can have the brain is dead, but the heart is still alive. And then it comes to a second level where the heart also dies. Now, in order for a heart transplant, and I'm not ruling the halachan, I'm just discussing it. In order for, you can't take out a dead heart and transplant it. Obviously, because it's dead. So in order for science to do a heart transplant, medicine, but if you take out the heart, you're killing the patient. Mm-hmm. So they wait until the patient is brain dead. And meanwhile, the heart is still functioning. And then they'll take out the living heart and they'll keep it going until they transplant it into another person. That's basically the concept. Now, again, I'm not saying what the ruling is. But let's say the Gemara defines death as respiratory death, meaning when the heart stops. If that's the halachic definition in the Gemara, because that's relevant at the time of the Gemara, they discussed that. So if the Torah, the Gemara decides, let's say, that death is respiratory death, then Torah says you're not allowed to do a heart transplant. Because if you take out the heart earlier, then you're killing the patient. And you don't kill, and the Gemara says, generally, a different rule, you're not allowed to kill one person to save another person. This person's going to die in 10 minutes, and this person might live another 30 years. It's totally irrelevant. You don't deal with lies like that. You don't say, I'm going to kill you because, you know, you're going to live longer. You're not allowed to kill somebody, even though somebody else is going to live longer. So now, based on that, does the Gemara discuss heart transplants? 100%. Of course the Gemara is discussing heart transplants. Will you find heart transplants in the Gemara? Of course not. Now, I'm just doing it because you said it. A Shabbos elevator. Will you find the concept of a Shabbos elevator in the Gemara? 100% not. Okay? Are you allowed to go on a Shabbos elevator if it stops every floor by itself? Right? But the Gemara will discuss the concept of it. Meaning, when you go into an elevator, interestingly, more so when you go down than when you go up, you add weight. The weight is indirectly causing more power to be used. It's causing more power to be because it's more weight. if it's more weight, you need more power to carry something heavier than something lighter. But it's indirect. I'm not directly making more power. My weight is indirectly causing more power to happen. Okay? So now the question is direct only forbidden, or is indirect power also forbidden? That the Gemara talks about. That the Gemara talks about. So it's not necessary for the Gemara to talk about Shabbos elevators. What the rabbis in future generations do, they apply biblical or Talmudical or codifier concepts to modern day technology. So therefore, is heart transplants taught in the Gemara? Yes and no. Is it clearly discussed in the Gemara? No. But is the halacha of it discussed in the Gemara 100%?
But there was, at the time when they discussed all the things, there was a perfect halacha who said, okay, so we cut this, we will decide that. So on those issues, there was nothing, never halacha stated, if this or that. It's just...
When?
On those details, like for example, what the Gemara discussed, it stays on the level of different point of view of discussion. There's no upset.
But there is guidelines in halacha which ruling you follow.
Okay, but if someone comes today and really want to do a heart surgery, and he said, okay, I want to see in the Talmud what they discussed about, he sees that the discussion did happen, but what is exactly they have said? What is the...
But so that's why you have codifiers, the codifiers that rule based on what's going on in the Talmud.
So you still have to refer to someone who gives you the posek.
Correct.
Okay.
That's why you need rabbis to make the halachic ruling. But they're not making their own rulings.
No.
It's not man-made rulings. That's what I'm bringing out. What?
Was it the first 40 days or the second 40 days that he learned it?
First. When he came down with the luchas, and the Jews were worshipping the golden calf, so he broke the luchas. I mean, you know. So anyway, how do we get to that? Oh, that was your question originally. The question was, how did they get all these interpretations? So, therefore, a lot of times they're alluded to in the pasuk clearly. For instance, if one sentence in Torah says, they went out to get the man, and another sentence says it was right outside their door. So that's the contradiction, right? So what's the explanation of the contradiction? If you were righteous, it was right outside your door. If you weren't so righteous, you had to walk further for it. One time it says about the month they had to grind it. And another pasuk says they baked it. Another pasuk says they ate it. So again, how do you reconcile the differences? So oral tradition teaches us that if you were a tzaddik, it was ready to eat. And if not, it had to be... processed a little bit, in other words, it had to be processed more. That's the way it works. It's very simple. Okay. So therefore he's saying he's going to make it rain from the heaven and to see if the Jews will follow in the ways of Torah or not. Now, the obvious question is, and we discussed this in different aspects, does God need to test us to see if we're going in Torah? God doesn't know. Why do you give a test? A teacher gives a test, well, it depends where. Sometimes teachers give tests just for the kids to review the work. The teacher will tell you beforehand whatever your kid's going to get. A good teacher doesn't need to give tests to know how well the kids are doing. They'll tell you exactly what each kid's going to get on the test.
She tests herself.
No, she wants the kids to review. And how do you get kids to review? This is the way you get them to review. But let's say even... in a university, college level, where the professor doesn't even know the kids, right? So you give a test to know if they're doing well or they're not doing well. But the question is, God doesn't need to give tests. God knows what you're doing. So why is the pasuk saying over here that Hashem is saying, Lemana Nasenu, to test them, that God said I should test them to see if they'll follow in the ways of Torah or not. Doesn't God know what they're doing? So the commentators explain, that the test is not for God to know. God is showing the person, I want you to know if you're following in the ways of Torah, the man will come one way. And if you don't follow the ways of Torah, the man will come in a different way. That's the simple meaning of it. A much deeper meaning of it, Lemana Nesenu, literally means to test you to see if you're going to follow in the ways of Torah or not. The deeper meaning of the test is not a test. Like we discussed this many times. Neis, which is the root of Nisoyen, Anasenu, the root is Neis. The word Neis has three interpretations. It means miracle. Neis is a miracle. Nisoyen is a test. And Neis, another interpretation of Neis, we say every day, three times a day in Shemin Esrei, means a banner. V'sa Neis, Lekabez Goli Yesenu, means you should pick up a banner. Neis in Hebrew, even flying today, is just called Tos in Hebrew. It was all connected to the concept of Nun Samach, which is flying. These three concepts, miracle, test, or challenge, and flying high, are all interconnected. It's three of the same. When a person has a challenge, and rather than the word test, I'm going to use the word challenge. When a person is given a challenge that causes them to fly much greater and higher than they would be able to accomplish if they didn't have the test.
And they wait for a Ness.
No, and by doing that, Ness means miracle, supernatural. You reach the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Meaning, the concept of a challenge, and this is why according to Chassidus, people should be happy when they're challenged. Because,
every day.
Huh?
Not every day.
Yeah, well, every day we daven not to get challenged. Doesn't matter. The bigger the challenge, the greater the accomplishment, and a Jew understands simultaneously that if God gives us the challenge, He simultaneously gives us the ability to pass the challenge. Because it would be pretty foolish from Hashem to give us a test that we can't do. Just like in school, like we mentioned many times, if a teacher gives a kid a test that they can't do well on, so something's wrong with the teacher. You don't give a test that everybody's going to fail. It's an idiotic teacher.
Happens a lot.
I know, there's a lot of idiotic teachers.
There are a lot of idiotic students.
No.
Yes.
No. I've never heard of it.
I've been waiting here.
Quietly and peacefully.
Let me just make one quick comment.
Yeah.
All the great universities of this country would be empty if it weren't for tests.
What?
You heard me? Stanford, UCLA, UC Berkeley, Carnegie Tech, Duke University, those schools.
Hey, how about Harvard and Yale?
And Harvard and Yale.
Good,
and
that's please.
And the Chabad Yeshiva.
Ottawa, that's it.
You can't get in. I taught for 31 years.
We all know about it.
Kidding around. And
so does everybody that hears the internet, by the way.
Five times a day to 31, you know, for 31 years. A lot of kids. And they got good grades on tests.
If they paid them.
They got good grades on the reports. They got an A. They got a B. They could get into college.
Okay. Kanugnu.
And if I didn't want to fail any Jewish kid when I was in Fairfax.
Okay.
Wow, I'm not going to fail Jewish kids. But I finally failed one. And he went into the Navy.
And he became the President of the United States. Anyway, listen. So the whole concept of Hashem Lemana Nesenu is not the test for Hashem to know what we're going to do, because Hashem knows what we're going to be doing. What is this concept on Asenu of the Hashem elevating the Jew? And that's the concept of a test. The concept of a test of challenge that Hashem gives us is because when Hashem gives us a test, and by the way, the greater the person, the greater the challenge. The greater the person, the greater the challenge. And Hashem gives the person the ability to overcome the challenge. And when the person is given the challenge by Hashem and they make an effort and they pass the test, so then they reach a level that they would never otherwise be able to reach. So not that God needs the test to know Hayelech b'seirasi imloi, if we're going to be going in the Torah or not. Hashem doesn't need a test. Hashem gives the test for people to prove it to themselves and to other people. But it's not for Hashem. And when a person gets a test, given higher levels or not. And the greater the person, like we said before, the greater the person, the greater the challenges. And when a person passes a lower challenge, Hashem says, okay, now you proved yourself on a lower level, we're going to take you to a higher level. We're going to give you a harder test, and a harder challenge, and a harder challenge. By the way, a little secret, you know when the challenges end? After 120 years, when they're put in the box, the challenges are over. Mm-hmm. But until then, there's challenges.
That's why the first 100 years of the life is
not... It's easier. Oh, it's hard. Then it gets easy. Ask the people over 100, they'll tell you it's not so easy. Okay, so therefore they're not allowed to gather from one day to the next. Hashem wants to see if the Jews are going to be listening to the mitzvahs, okay, of the man and so on. V'haya b'yem ha-shishi, but it will be on the sixth day, meaning on Friday. No, we graduated to 384. Yes, verse 5. V'haya b'yem ha-shishi will be on the sixth day, meaning Friday. V'echino es ha-she yaviyu, and they will prepare what they are brought. V'haya mishna ala she yuktu yem yem, it's going to be double. Hashem is telling them that just right away from the beginning, on Friday you're going to get a double portion. While we're on this topic of Friday, I mean, while we're discussing it, the man, when the man fell, it was a unique way that the man fell from heaven. There was a layer of dew, the man fell on top of it, and then another layer of dew covered the man on top. That's why on Shabbos, when we have two challahs representing the double portion of man that they got for Shabbos, the custom is you cover the chalas. So one reason you cover the chalas is because not to embarrass the wine. But another reason, it says why you cover the challah, is because the man was covered underneath and on top. So if you have a tablecloth or a napkin or a board, whatever, and then you have the challah cover on top, of course, to remind us of the miracle that happened with the man, that the man was covered underneath and on top. So the miracle was that on Friday, no matter what they gathered during the week, it always came out to be double. And this is what Hashem is telling Moshe to tell the Jews, and as we'll soon see later in Chumash, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't give over the whole message. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't tell them about the double man. And that's why it says later, not here, but in the later Pasuk, it says that they found double. And they came to Moshe Rabbeinu, they said, why is it double? So Moshe Rabbeinu says, oh, by the way, that's what God told me to tell you, that on Friday you're going to get double. But Moshe Rabbeinu on his own didn't tell the Jews the entire message of Hashem. And Hashem got angry at him for not giving over the entire message. When we get to that part, we'll discuss, the commentators explain why. Yeah, because the man fell double. Yeah. That's every meal that you eat on Shabbos, you need two challahs. In fact, the commentators explain that everything that happens on Shabbos, is double. There's two challahs, there's two candles. The Mefarshim elaborate a lot on all the doubles. Everything of Shabbos is double because of the double portion of the man that fell. There were two korbanos instead of one. I mean, there was a lot of things. Another thing, which is very important over here, that the Baal HaTorim says, why over here by the Mon is the Torah saying, I'm testing you to see if you will go in the Torah or not. So we discussed the simple meaning of it is to see if the Jews will keep the mitzvahs connected to the Mon. But there's a much deeper significance. The Medrash says, the Gemara says, Torah was not given, Lenitna Torah elu la'ichli haman. Torah was only given to the people that ate the Mon. That's what the Medrash. So what does it mean that the Torah was given to the people that ate the Mon? So the commentators explain very simply. If you really want to have Torah, you need to be completely in it. You need to be completely in it. We'll learn later one of the reasons why the spies came back with a negative report of Israel, why they didn't want to go into Eretz Yisrael, the ten spies, was because in the desert they were in utopia. They were in bliss. They had no working problems. They didn't have to work. They had all the food taken care of. They had all the clothing with the clouds taken care of. They had the water taken care of. All their physical needs were taken care of. They were able to sit and study Torah a whole day. Now they're going to have to go into Israel. The Mon's going to stop. They're going to have to start working for a living. And they won't be able to sit and study Torah a whole day. So the spies came back and said, we don't want to go into Eretz Yisrael. It's a land that consumes its inhabitants, meaning it's a land that doesn't allow you to keep Torah, to really get into learning. So the Gemara says that Torah was only given la'ichli haman to the people that ate the man, that were part of the man. Meaning, when a person wants to be involved in learning, they have to be on the level of the guys that ate the man. Meaning, no concerns, no worries, no distractions, completely involved in the learning of Torah. So that's why by the man, Hashem uses the expression l'mana nasenu. This is the test, if you're going to go in the ways of Torah or not. Because now you have no more excuses. You don't have an excuse, you have to go work for a living. You know, you have to run away here or run away there. The Mon is taking care of all your needs, so therefore let me see if you're going to be sitting and learning Torah all day. The Rebbe explains, the same thing really applies to us also. Even though we don't have the Mon, and we don't sit and learn Torah all day, but the Rebbe explains, when the Gemara says the expression, the Torah was not given only to people that ate the Mon, it means at the time a person is studying, they should be on a level of the people that ate the Mon, meaning there are no distractions. Like we said many times, the Gemara says that a Talmud Chacham is called Shabbos, meaning when you study Torah, it's like Shabbos. What do you mean like Shabbos? If a person is Shomer Shabbos, and the phone rings on Shabbos, you don't answer the phone. You don't even think about answering the phone. You know that you and the phone have no connection on Shabbos. You know, somebody wants to do business. There's no business on Shabbos. So the same thing the Gemara says, when a person studies Torah, they have to be so involved in the learning that there's no distractions, like just like the guys that ate the Mon. So the Baal HaTorim explains, that's what the Pasuk is saying here. Hanathanam, God is testing us with the Mon to see Ayelach b'Teirasi Yimlei, if you're going to be completely devoted to learning Torah, that is connected to the people that ate the Mon because they had no other concerns, no other worries. There are three things, we have 2 minutes. There are three things that they had in the desert, like we said before. They had the Mon, they had the water, Miriam's well, as it's called. And then they had the clouds of glory that traveled with them. It evened out the mountains and it covered them and it protected them from the rain and it protected them from the snakes and scorpions and it washed their clothes and it did all the miracles. So the Medrash says that the Mon came in the merit of Moshe, the water came in the merit of Miriam, and the clouds came in the merit of Aaron. Therefore, when Miriam died later on in Chumash, all of a sudden they had no water. So Moshe may not have to hit the rock. When Aaron died, the clouds of glory left, and they had to come back in the merit of Moshe again. And we'll discuss why each one had their own one. But the Mon was in the merit of Moshe. Because Moshe is the Inyan of Torah. Torah is the food. Torah is food, as David HaMelech says in Tillim, Torascha b'seich me'ay, your Torah is in my stomach. Meaning, Torah, in order for it to work, you gotta digest it. You have to chew it, you have to live it, and then you have Torah. Torah is water also. Torah is fire also. Torah is whatever you want. But in this respect, in this aspect, in other words, Torah is bread, Torah is water, Torah is fire, Torah is a bunch of things. In a certain quality of water, Torah has. A certain quality of bread, you know. But therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu is saying over here, God's saying basically, that the man is the test about keeping Torah. Because when you learn Torah, you have to be on the level of a person that ate the man.
But you also have to go to the land and conquer the land and work for to sustain yourself. So Torah is also...
Yeah, but that's what I said. That's why you have, in the life of a religious Jew, yeshiva boy, no, yeshiva bacher, no worries, everything's taken care of. Right, the parents or whatever, the yeshiva, whatever, right? But then God says, get married and get out of here.
I mean when they,
yeah, but what I'm saying is, what the Rebbe is explaining, that even though a person works, but if they come to learn every day, and Jew has an obligation to learn every day, during that hour of learning, a half an hour, whatever,